In a nation defined by reinvention, yoga has undergone one of the most remarkable transformations in American cultural history. What began as a feared heathen practice has evolved into a multi-billion dollar industry embraced by celebrities, suburban moms, and corporate executives alike. This journey from obscurity to ubiquity reveals not just how yoga changed America, but how America fundamentally changed yoga. The practice that once shocked Victorian sensibilities now adorns magazine covers and fills studios in every city. Yet beneath the polished surface of modern yoga lies a fascinating history of cultural adaptation, spiritual seeking, and occasional scandal. From Thoreau's solitary experiments at Walden Pond to Madonna's Sanskrit chants, yoga's American evolution reflects our nation's complex relationship with spirituality, the body, and the eternal search for meaning. What makes this story particularly compelling is how yoga repeatedly challenged American dualities between mind and body, becoming one of the most successfully assimilated aspects of Asian culture, while multiplying the number of divine interlocutors available to spiritual seekers. At its core remains the tantalizing possibility that through disciplined practice, one might become what one worships, whether called God, superconsciousness, Brahman, or simply the self. The Emerson family's intellectual engagement with Hindu texts in the early 1800s laid crucial groundwork for America's future embrace of yoga. By 1842, Ralph Waldo Emerson had left his pastorate, become a successful lecturer, and founded The Dial, which published translations of Buddhist and Hindu texts. His reading expanded to include the Vishnu Purana, Sankhya Karika, and the Bhagavad Gita, with Hindu concepts increasingly appearing in his essays and poetry. In 1843, Emerson acquired Wilkins' translation of the Bhagavad Gita, mistakenly calling it the much-renowned Book of Buddhism. The Gita, part of the epic Mahabharata, depicts Krishna convincing the warrior Arjuna to fight against his own kinsmen by expounding spiritual philosophy. Krishna's message centers on knowing the divine, which enables action without sin. This text is considered by some to be the first full-fledged yoga scripture, describing several types of yoga meditation, devotion, bhakti, and selfless action, karma. 2 years after obtaining Wilkins' translation, Emerson wrote the first lines of his poem Brahma, directly responding to Krishna's teaching that it neither killeth nor is it killed. Emerson completed the poem a decade later, incorporating concepts from the Gita and Upanishads. He also created a mini dictionary of Sanskrit terms, defining yoga simply as the effort to unite with the deity, concentration. When Brahma appeared in the inaugural issue of The Atlantic in 1857, it confused many readers, becoming something of a joke. Even the magazine's editor, James Russell Lowell, questioned, "What the deuce have we to do with Brahma?" Yet others recognized it as a skillful articulation of Indian philosophy. William T. Harris praised it for condensing the yoga doctrine into 4 short verses. While Emerson engaged with yoga intellectually, his friend Henry David Thoreau attempted to live it. Thoreau's retreat to Walden Pond transformed him into what some would call America's first yogi. After Ellen Sewell refused his marriage proposal in 1840, Thoreau found himself free of family obligations and built a simple cabin on Emerson's land, determined to live deliberately. Unlike Emerson, Thoreau read Hindu texts as practical instruction manuals. His daily rituals included morning bathing in the pond, vegetarian diet, unleavened bread, eventually abandoning bread altogether, drinking only water, and practicing chastity, all purifications he connected to the mind's approximation of God. On summer mornings after bathing, Thoreau would sit in his doorway wrapped in reverie for hours, practicing what Krishna calls yoga in the Bhagavad Gita, meditation. Though his asceticism has been exaggerated, his cabin was near train tracks, he received visitors, and occasionally ate fish, Thoreau embraced the moderate path advocated in the Gita. He criticized both his neighbor's unconscious enslavement to commerce and the extreme penances of some Brahmins, believing both missed the finer fruits of life. Unlike traditional yogis seeking dissolution into Brahman, Thoreau aspired to a different kind of yoga, one that heightened perception while preserving individuality. he transformed writing itself into yogic practice, seeing his artistic labor as devotion. In Walden's conclusion, he inserted a parable about an artist of Kuru whose single-pointed concentration created the fairest of all creations of Brahma, not by dissolving into the divine, but by exalting individual genius through devoted practice. The 1893 World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago created the perfect stage for Eastern spirituality to enter American consciousness. This white city of neoclassical grandeur hosted the Parliament of Religions, where Swami Vivekananda would make his historic appearance. Despite organizers' intentions to demonstrate Christian superiority, the Parliament unexpectedly provided a platform for authentic Eastern voices. Against a backdrop of Victorian social transformation, the exposition created receptive conditions for Vivekananda's message to reach Americans hungry for new forms of spiritual expression beyond conventional Christianity. Born in Bengal in 1863, Swami Vivekananda, born Narendranath Datta, arrived in America driven by national pride and duty. Though Western educated, he opposed Christian missionary efforts in India. With a bleeding heart, he wrote, "I have crossed half the world to this strange land seeking help." His mission was to raise funds for India's impoverished masses and thereby regenerate his homeland. He faced significant challenges, not only America's financial depression, but also deeply entrenched negative perceptions of Hinduism spread by missionaries who portrayed Hindu deities as licentious and devotees as frenzied. The 1893 World Parliament of Religions, though organized with Christian triumphalism in mind, inadvertently became a showcase for Eastern traditions. Despite Christians delivering three-quarters of the papers, Asian delegates became the main attraction. The audience, predominantly female, would often make a rush for the exits after speakers from India finished. Vivekananda particularly captivated crowds. The Chicago Inter-Ocean reported great crowds of people, the most of whom were women, pressing around doors to hear the popular Hindu monk who looks so much like McCullough's Othello. Vivekananda's extraordinary appeal stemmed from his ability to simultaneously fulfill and debunk Orientalist stereotypes. His appearance, scarlet robes and yellow turban, satisfied Western expectations of an exotic sage, yet his behavior confounded them. He ate meat and ice cream, smoked, used snuff, and spoke fluent, sonorous English. Unlike the passive immobility Westerners expected of yogis, he gestured dramatically during lectures, displaying a fierce, leonine presence that one observer compared to Napoleon. In summer 1894, Sarah Chapman Bull and Sarah Jane Farmer transformed Green Acre Hotel in Maine into a spiritual retreat, providing critical infrastructure for Vivekananda's American teaching career. The 8-week program featured lectures on spiritual, mental, and moral topics. Vivekananda taught extensively, including lessons on yoga that described concentrating nerve force in different plexuses or lotuses. Bull later organized the Cambridge Conference's annex, where Vivekananda taught Raja Yoga through Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, introducing Western students to this systematic approach largely overlooked by earlier transcendentalists. In his Raja Yoga classes, Vivekananda boldly claimed yoga was as much a science as any in the world, one that could make matter our slave. He translated Patanjali sutras and provided practical instructions, sitting firm as a rock with proper spinal alignment, thinking of each body part as perfect, breathing techniques, and meditation on the glory of that being who created this universe. Though these exercises seem mild compared to modern yoga practices, they challenged Victorian norms, particularly for corseted women who would have struggled with deep breathing exercises. Vivekananda explained the 8 limbs of Raja Yoga, but quickly veered from Patanjali's path to introduce Kundalini and the subtle body concepts. He spoke frankly about the generative substance of sexual energy, symbolized as a tiny serpent coiled up at the base of the spine, shocking for Victorian America, where even mentioning bodily functions was taboo. He described the Sushumna as a brilliant thread strung with 6 lotuses, and explained how awakening Kundalini involved raising this energy through these centers to reach spiritual consciousness. Vivekananda's teachings blended his guru Ramakrishna's experiences with metaphysical language familiar to Americans.
Unlike Vivekananda's systematic approach, Ramakrishna's understanding came from personal experience, spontaneous trance-like states from childhood, and later experiments with various disciplines, including Tantra. During his tantric phase, Ramakrishna reportedly experienced kundalini rising through his susumna, making each of the six lotuses bloom. Despite falling short of raising large sums for India's poorest, Vivekananda's American journey transformed the Ramakrishna order. Western women like Sarah Bull and Henrietta Muller donated thousands of dollars while embracing yoga and Vedanta, while in India, more young Hindus took vows as sannyasis. By fall 1899, the order had established permanent headquarters at Belur Math. Success brought internal conflicts, with some monks criticizing Vivekananda for straying from Ramakrishna's teachings, a valid concern, as master and disciple differed significantly. With Ramakrishna leaving no written teachings, disciples like Vivekananda could craft their own versions of the master's message.
In summer 1919, Pierre Bernard and his wife Blanche DeVries expanded their Manhattan yoga school by opening the Braeburn Country Club in Nyack, New York. Financed by Mrs. William K. Vanderbilt, the sprawling estate attracted wealthy socialites and artists. 10 committed students, including former Ziegfeld Follies dancers, helped restore the property. However, suspicious Nyack villagers spied on the club, and media attention grew when locals spotted students in black bloomers performing strange exercises. Despite Bernard's insistence that they only practiced health and outdoor activities, the police eventually raided the club. Bernard's journey began as Perry Baker in Lincoln, Nebraska, where he apprenticed with tantric yogi Sylvaise Hamadi instead of becoming a millwright. After 12 years of studying Vedic philosophy and Hatha Yoga, he demonstrated Kali Mudra, death simulation, in San Francisco in 1898, launching his professional career. Now called Pierre Arnold Bernard, he and Hamadi opened a clinic for nervous disorders. In 1905, Bernard established the Secretive Tantric Order, TO, where members paid $100 for initiation and advanced through 7 degrees. While mainstream Hindu reformers avoided Tantra's controversial reputation, Bernard embraced it, offering sexual teachings to advanced initiates through Kaula rites. His approach combined Indian Tantra with Western sex magic, though a 1910 scandal in New York City temporarily threatened his career. Bernard met Blanche DeVries, born Dace Melbourne Shannon, in 1913. A divorced singer with remarkable talent and beauty, she mastered Hatha Yoga and soon led Bernard's women's yoga school. Her Yoga Gymnosophy Institute on East 53rd Street exemplified modern yoga's refinement, featuring elegant facilities and expert instruction. The institute employed 12 instructors, many former dancers, who taught postures, breathing exercises, and advanced cleansing techniques. While sharing similarities with the New Thought movement's focus on mental healing, Bernard's tantric approach uniquely emphasized physical purification as a path to spiritual growth. This philosophy gave spiritual purpose to the pursuit of health and beauty, distinguishing his practice from other contemporary movements. In February 1937, Theos Bernard established a rigorous daily routine in Kalimpong, India, a Himalayan foothill town. Rising at 5 a.m. without heat or hot water, he practiced pranayama breathing exercises and studied Tibetan before walking a mile through lush tropical vegetation to his teacher's house. While few Western travelers visited Kalimpong, Theos's persistence led to a fortuitous encounter with an Indian yogi who claimed mastery of Hatha Yoga practices. The yogi impressed Bernard with his abilities, eating almost nothing, sleeping only 2 hours nightly, possessing photographic memory, speaking multiple languages fluently, and, most importantly, maintaining breath retention, kumbhaka, for 2 hours. Theos Bernard was Pierre Bernard's half-nephew, son of Glenn Bernard, who was also devoted to yoga. Unlike his uncle, Theos pursued academic credentials, working toward a doctorate in anthropology at Columbia University after abandoning a law career. His 1936-37 trip to India with his wife Viola was meant to gather dissertation research.
they had significant advantages in their search for authentic yoga instruction: youth and energy, connections through the CCC, letters of introduction, and most importantly, Glenn Bernard's extensive network of Indian yoga contacts. Despite strong interest in Theos Bernard's work, wartime paper rationing severely limited the distribution of his dissertation, Hatha Yoga. Columbia University printed just 500 copies initially, which sold out quickly. When they attempted to reprint it as a trade publication, paper scarcity allowed only 390 additional copies, hampering Theos's campaign to popularize Hatha Yoga for the average person. Theos refused to oversimplify yoga's complexity. Even when pressed to distill the practice to essentials, he named three demanding techniques: Padmasana, lotus position, Uddiyana, and Pranayama. His description of Uddiyana alone, requiring 1,500 repetitions daily of complete exhalation with vigorous abdominal contractions, demonstrated his unwillingness to make concessions to beginners. Yoga took hard work, he maintained, often reminding audiences they must pay the price for yogic knowledge. His insistence on preserving yoga's complexity stemmed partly from temperament, earnest, ambitious, and proud, and partly from witnessing his half-uncle, Pierre Bernard's, controversial career. Theos disdained Pierre's bread-and-circuses approach while sharing his vision of creating a center for in-depth study of tantric yoga and Tibetan Buddhism. He sought academic credentials as protection against misconceptions and impropriety. Theos challenged common stereotypes about yoga, that it required complete abdication of responsibilities, demanded austerity and self-denial, or consisted merely of acrobatics. He insisted yogis could enjoy food, drink, and sex, but with self-awareness of their limits. Yet when his marriage to wealthy patron Ganawalska collapsed, tabloid headlines like "He can't work, but he stands on his head for 3 hours" reinforced negative perceptions. In 1940, news broke that Margaret Woodrow Wilson, daughter of the 28th president, had found peace at Sri Aurobindo's ashram in Pondicherry, India. The former first daughter had indeed committed herself fully to yoga as a vocation. Margaret's spiritual journey began in 1932 when she discovered Aurobindo's Essays on the Gita at the New York Public Library. In Aurobindo's schema, humans were the penultimate stage in an evolutionary process culminating in supramental beings. This approach suited Margaret perfectly, as she maintained a strong belief in God's presence while rejecting organized religion. After her father's death in 1924, Margaret's yoga journey intensified. By 1937, she felt her entire life flowed from yoga practice. In spring 1938, Margaret finally received an invitation to Aurobindo's ashram. She spent her remaining inheritance on a round-trip ticket to India and sailed on September 6, 1938, telling only a few friends she would be gone as long as the spirit keeps me in India. When Margaret disembarked in Bombay, a Ramakrishna monk greeted her. Vivekananda's organization had become the de facto jumping-off point for Western seekers in India. She traveled alone by train to Pondicherry, arriving without incident. By November, she was settled at the ashram, delighted by nearly everything she found there. The ashram comprised over 50 French colonial buildings surrounding a central courtyard lush with tropical vegetation. Margaret lived in a house just outside its walls, with high ceilings, a garden, and 2 servants, more luxurious than her New York apartment. She received special privileges, including a shaded seat for meditation. Nearly 200 disciples lived at the ashram, and their devotion impressed her greatly. "I have never seen such a wonderful group of people in my life." Margaret worked diligently at yoga, meditating 3 times daily, morning, after lunch, and evening. Her one complaint? After several months, Margaret still hadn't met Aurobindo. The silent yogi spent most of the year in seclusion, communicating with disciples entirely through correspondence. He did offer darshan, a sighting, 3 times yearly. When Aurobindo finally emerged, Margaret was overwhelmed, considering him one of the fully persuaded world saviors, like Christ or Buddha, who had rent the veil of matter and existed beyond mind and speech. By summer 1939, following ashram policy, Margaret had turned most of her financial assets over to the mother, the Frenchwoman Mira Richards, who ran the ashram. Her dedication extended to significant financial support. In 1937, she donated $2,500, equivalent to between $34,000 and $338,000 in 2005 values, to the ashram, demonstrating her complete commitment to her new spiritual path. Despite World War II reaching India and the State Department's efforts to evacuate American civilians, Margaret chose to remain. She continued her spiritual work while also serving as a one-woman publicity machine for Aurobindo, sending his books to major universities and libraries across America, writing to scholars and university presidents, and leveraging her status as a former first daughter to promote his teachings. Through yoga, Margaret had found something akin to a career that focused her energies and made her feel useful. She believed that in changing herself through integral yoga, she was also changing the world. The effect of this yoga will be to radically change the makeup of man, gradually, of course. Margaret remained devoted to Aurobindo's teachings until the end of her life. She began experiencing meaningful progress in her meditation practice, describing moments of luminescence of mind that made her feel as if I have never lived or understood anything at all before. Though her friends urged her to return to America when she fell seriously ill, she refused. Margaret died in February 1944 from kidney failure at age 57. Her sister ultimately decided to leave her body in India, where she had wanted to be all along, a place where few would question her devotion to yoga. In the Hollywood Hills stands a distinctive white building topped with onion domes and gold pinnacles, the Hollywood Vedanta Temple. This architectural anomaly, resembling a miniature Taj Mahal, sits beside a Japanese-style farmhouse that served as the original headquarters of the Southern California Vedanta Society. Gerald Hurd, Aldous Huxley, and Christopher Isherwood formed an influential trio of British intellectuals who lent authority, relevance, and glamour to Swami Prabhavananda's small organization. Hurd became central to the temple's growth, lecturing on alternate Sundays and consistently emphasizing that Vedanta offered a complete system based on a clear realization of the body-mind relationship. His spellbinding talks significantly increased both attendance and donations. Swami Prabhavananda initiated both Hurd and Huxley, though neither considered himself a disciple. Huxley, already a literary star after Brave New World, had seamlessly integrated into Hollywood elite, writing screenplays while his movements were tracked by gossip columnists. His spiritual questing had become a defining aspect of his public persona. In Vedanta, he found another powerful articulation of perennial philosophy, the idea that God is both transcendent, Brahma, and immanent, with union with God being human existence's purpose. In 1941, Isherwood was initiated as a probationary monk at the Vedanta Center. The Southern California Vedanta Society's monastery was unconventional. Rather than a single building, it consisted of neighboring houses purchased by Prabhavananda. Monks lived at 1942 Ivar Avenue, Brahmananda Cottage, while nuns occupied number 1946, with the temple between them. The genders mingled freely for all activities except sleep. Despite his monastic status, Isherwood continued screenwriting to earn a living and maintained his Hollywood social life, lunching with the Huxleys, dining with the Brechts, and walking the beach with Greta Garbo. Nevertheless, his presence at the center signaled to Hollywood that Vedanta could withstand intellectual scrutiny, and Prabhavananda's acceptance of the openly gay Isherwood demonstrated remarkable tolerance. Throughout the 1940s, the center attracted increasing numbers of Hollywood figures. Greta Garbo lunched there in 1943, sighing about how wonderful it must be to be a nun. Somerset Maugham visited in 1941 and later sought Prabhavananda's advice on his film The Razor's Edge. By 1945, though Isherwood and Huxley had moved on, their association with the Vedanta Society had energized yoga in America. The Prabhavananda Isherwood translation of the Bhagavad Gita sold nearly 250,000 copies. By the 1940s, Los Angeles had become notorious for its spiritual eccentricity. Ogden Nash captured this reputation in verse, calling the city erratic, erotic, esoteric, and exotic. Critics described it as the world's prized collection of cranks filled with food fads, sunbathing, ancient Greek costumes, diaphragm breathing, and apocalyptic expectations. In 1925, Paramahansa Yogananda arrived in Los Angeles to a reception of pomp and splendor honored by civic leaders at the Biltmore Hotel. Unlike Prabhavananda, who dismissed the body as merely a gross distraction, Yogananda saw physical well-being as key to spiritual growth. He developed his Yogoda system, incorporating elements of Hatha Yoga despite publicly disdaining it as inferior. During lectures, he would demonstrate his physical prowess by pushing furniture with his abdominal muscles or instantly assuming lotus position. His genius for organization proved even more impressive than his spiritual synthesis. In Los Angeles, his popularity exceeded all expectations, with thousands reportedly turned away from his lectures. In 1925, Yogananda purchased the Mount Washington Hotel as his headquarters. Within a decade, his Yogoda Satsanga Society of America boasted 12 centers nationwide, governed by prominent Americans, including an ex-mayor of New York City and a renowned Cleveland architect. In January 1947, a petite woman with pale skin, brown hair, and blue eyes arrived in Hollywood. Speaking perfect English with a Russian accent and typically dressed in a sari, she called herself Indra Devi. Soon after arriving, she opened a small Hatha yoga studio at 8806 Sunset Boulevard. Despite friends' warning that the word yoga would evoke thoughts of cults and charlatans, she boldly put up a sign announcing Indra Devi yoga classes. Her minimalist studio featured whitewashed walls and matted floors, projecting order and discipline in stark contrast to the festive atmosphere of the Vedanta Center. As a teacher, Devi was both gracious and exacting, adhering to core principles. Hatha yoga contained everything needed for perfect health and spiritual realization. It suited busy modern lives, and spiritual matters required a guru. Her gentle classes began with breathing exercises, followed by postures like cobra and locust, and ended with relaxation. Unlike Theos Bernard's intense practice, Devi insisted that straining defeated the purpose. Tight joints would release themselves over time with regular practice. Within a few years, Devi attracted A-list celebrities including Greta Garbo, Gloria Swanson, and Jennifer Jones. Her success wasn't accidental. She had lived most of her life among royalty and elites. Born Eugenie Peterson in Latvia in 1899 to a Swedish banker father and Russian nobility on her mother's side, she fled the Russian Revolution to Berlin, where she became an actress and dancer. In India in 1929, she adopted her stage name and briefly became the new rising star of Indian screen before marrying a Czech diplomat. Her yoga journey began after Prince Mussoorie of Nepal demonstrated asanas, leading her to study with Sri T. Krishnamacharya despite his initial reluctance to teach a Western woman. Los Angeles had a huge pent-up demand for Hatha yoga instruction. Until Devi's arrival, the city had no Hatha yoga school, with qualified teachers concentrated in New York. The confusion was so prevalent that when Devi lectured to a Los Angeles Eaters Anonymous meeting, someone mistook yoga for yogurt. Another obstacle was that many yoga poses resembled standard calisthenics and gymnastics warm-ups that had become popular during the war years, with actresses like Susan Hayward and Bette Davis including them in their fitness regimens. By the 1950s, yoga had spread so efficiently through Southern California that, like the eucalyptus and bougainvillea, people mistook it for a native species. Los Angeles yoga teachers became the most prolific in the country, producing best-selling books. Christopher Isherwood and Swami Prabhavananda followed their successful Bhagavad Gita translation with How to Know God, the Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali, in 1953. Indra Devi's second book, Yoga for Americans, published in 1959, marked a significant shift in her presentation of yoga. While her first book had stripped yoga of its spiritual elements, this new work began reintroducing them. The book featured the Om symbol on its cloth cover and detailed explanations of the subtle body. In Lesson 4, she described the awakening of Kundalini, the nadis and chakras, and explicitly stated that raising Kundalini could lead to samadhi, union with universal consciousness. By reintroducing these spiritual aspects, Devi was providing the counterculture with materials they would soon embrace. Her consistent personal style, wearing saris and teaching barefoot, also pointed toward the coming cultural shift. As the 1960s approached, the hippies, Allen Ginsberg, Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, and other psychic explorers wouldn't need to travel to India or study obscure texts. They could simply open a book intended for middle-class housewives to discover these spiritual concepts. In 1968, Life magazine's Year of the Guru, the Beatles' arrival at Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's Rishikesh Ashram for transcendental meditation study became a cultural milestone. After declaring they no longer needed drugs for spiritual fulfillment, the group immersed themselves in meditation, received special treatment, and wrote prolifically before departing amid controversy over Maharishi's alleged behavior with female students. Maharishi's TM system represented a modernized approach to Eastern spirituality, stripped of traditional elements. The 1960s marked a dramatic shift in yoga's American evolution. While earlier teachers like Indra Devi had successfully secularized yoga into health exercises, the counterculture renewed interest in its spiritual dimensions, largely through social scientists Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert. Aldous Huxley's 1953 mescaline experience, documented in The Doors of Perception, linked psychedelics to religious experience. Despite criticism from traditional spiritual leaders, Huxley's advocacy influenced Timothy Leary, who began researching psychedelics at Harvard. Leary and colleague Richard Alpert's experiments, first at Harvard, then at Milberg Mansion, positioned LSD as modern yoga made possible by science. By 1966, LSD use had spread widely across America. The counterculture celebrated the connection between yoga and psychedelics, culminating in symbolic marriages on both coasts. The Mantra Rock Dance in San Francisco exemplified this fusion, featuring the Grateful Dead alongside Srila Prabhupada's chanting while psychedelic Krishna images pulsed on walls. The relationship between yoga and psychedelics evolved from equivalence to progression. Richard Alpert transformed into Ram Dass, abandoning psychedelics for pranayama and meditation. Allen Ginsberg similarly progressed from psychedelic experiences to finding spiritual fulfillment through chanting. At the turbulent 1968 Democratic Convention, he demonstrated yoga's power by maintaining hours of peaceful meditation amid chaos, describing the experience as accessing cellular extensions of cosmic consciousness. By 1969, yoga had penetrated American culture at multiple levels. Swami Satchidananda gave the invocation at Woodstock, arriving by helicopter to address nearly 500,000 people. Meanwhile, Richard Hittleman opened the largest full-time yoga college in the USA above New York's Grand Central Station. By 1974, Time magazine declared yoga was rapidly becoming as much a part of American life as organic apple pie. The Immigration and Nationalization Act of 1965 eliminated the quota system that had restricted Asian immigration, making it easier for Indian swamis to stay in America. This change brought a wave of influential yoga teachers to American shores. Swami Satchidananda arrived in 1966 for what was supposed to be a two-day stopover, but stayed 5 months. By 1970, he claimed hundreds of thousands of followers, with integral yoga institutes established across the country. Swami Muktananda, arriving in 1970 and returning for his Meditation Revolution tour from 1974 to 1976, stood apart from other gurus. His specialty was Shaktipat, the direct transmission of spiritual energy from guru to student. Poet and critic Paul Zweig, a self-described tolerant atheist, experienced this firsthand in 1974. Despite minimal interaction with Muktananda, who didn't even speak English, Zweig found himself overwhelmed with intense feelings after their meeting, his body becoming buoyant and warm and experiencing pure aerial energy simply from sitting in the Swami's presence. In May 1975, seven Californians, including Rama Vernon, Judith and Ike Lassiter, and William Golden, launched Yoga Journal with volunteer staff, unpaid submissions, and distribution by a Bay Area gay pornography company. Their mission was partly to convince Americans that yoga wasn't weird, not voodoo, countering misconceptions that seemed increasingly urgent. This publication filled a crucial media gap, an insider voice that, like Runner's World, would serve the subculture without limiting itself to a single teacher or technique. By the early 1960s, yoga had become a staple of daytime television. Lilias Folin's show featured her in simple sets, wearing red leotards with Om symbols, using Sanskrit names while focusing on physical benefits. Time magazine predicted she would become the Julia Child of yoga. These television pioneers, along with Yoga Journal's founders, had learned valuable lessons about making yoga accessible to mainstream America. The magazine favored scientific language and physiology, running articles like Yoga and the Endocrine System alongside spiritual topics like symbology of the Om. By the mid-1970s, stories of coercion and duplicity began emerging, particularly around ISKCON, the Hare Krishnas. Meanwhile, BKS Iyengar effectively stripped religion from yoga, forbidding instructors to teach meditation and chanting while focusing exclusively on poses and pranayama. He viewed the asana practice as meditation itself, creating slow, methodical, physically demanding classes with meticulous attention to anatomy and alignment. His studios featured distinctive wood-paneled walls with pulleys resembling old-fashioned gymnasiums. Iyengar developed props, wooden blocks, ropes, pulleys, and strategically placed blankets to help students assume challenging poses more easily. In November 1976, Ram Dass published a confession in Yoga Journal titled Egg on My Beard, revealing how his spiritual journey had gone awry. After his guru Maharaji's death in 1973, Dass became entangled with Joya Santayana, formerly Joyce Green, a Brooklyn housewife who claimed to channel Maharaji. Their relationship became sexual, though Joya demanded celibacy from followers. Dass eventually broke with her, claiming she had manipulated him through sleep deprivation, bullying, and theatrical spiritual displays. Major news outlets began publishing exposés of sexual hypocrisy and power abuses by popular gurus. Muktananda was accused of having sexual relationships with numerous young devotees while publicly insisting on strict celibacy as the source of his spiritual authority. More scandals followed. Swami Satchidananda was accused by former secretary Susan Cohen of sexual misconduct. By the early 1990s, the reverence Americans had shown these men for nearly 2.5 decades appeared a grave mistake. Hatha yoga's American resurgence was marked by two shifts: the introduction of sweat-inducing practice and increased male participation, primarily through Bikram Chowdhury and Sri K. Pattabhi Joyce in the 1970s. Bikram's signature style featured 105-degree heat, mirrors, and fluorescent lighting. Students endured 90 minutes of 26 poses performed twice, with the mirrors enforcing self-correction. Opening his first Los Angeles school with celebrity support, Bikram's physically demanding classes attracted Hollywood elite. His success was unprecedented. By 1984, his Beverly Hills school generated roughly $1,000 daily with $20 classes. In contrast, Sri K. Pattabhi Joyce brought Ashtanga yoga to America in 1975, teaching a more austere practice. His method emphasized continuous movement linked to breath, vinyasa, with 6 progressive series of postures. Though different in approach, both teachers reintroduced religious elements through physical rigor, requiring devotional practice 6 days weekly. By 1994, yoga in America had become synonymous with Hatha yoga's physical practices. The mid-1990s saw the emergence of urban yoga and power yoga, marketed for their cardiovascular benefits. Jivamukti yoga, founded by Sharon Gannon and David Leif, exemplified this evolution by combining intense physical practice with spiritual elements. Their success culminated in a 9,000-square-foot studio in New York by 1998. Madonna's 1998 Ray of Light album featuring Sanskrit chants marked yoga's full mainstream arrival. By 2002, practitioners had grown from 6 million to 15 to 18 million Americans, generating billions in revenue. The 2009 memorial service for Pattabhi Joyce at Donna Karan's Urban Zen Center demonstrated yoga's broad acceptance, reflecting wider cultural shifts, including America's growing Indian population and scientific validation of yoga's benefits. This evolution revealed yoga's mature paradox. simultaneously serving as both indulgence and penance, capable of physical transformation and spiritual awakening. Daily, practitioners continue this tradition, unrolling mats like prayer rugs, chanting to Ganesha, and finding their practice amidst the urban symphony of city life.